It's 10:06. Good morning. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. For some, the recent economic collapse was just the most recent evidence of the unsustainability, if that's a word, of our commercial system. A system based on the Quaker principle of right relationship is the main thrust of a new book by Peter Brown and Jeffrey Garver titled Right Relationship, Building a Whole Earth Economy. Joining me by phone to talk about this book this morning is one of the two authors of the work, Jeffrey Garver, an environmental consultant and lecturer in law in Montreal, and a member of the Board of Trustees of the Quaker Institute for the Future. Good morning, Mr. Garver, and welcome to the program.
Good morning, Mr. Munson. It's terrific to be with you this morning.
Well, let's start with discussion, or at least a definition, of that Quaker principle of right relationship.
Well, right relationship has a long history and resonance within Quakerism and within other religious and cultural traditions. It's really the idea of living your life true to the spiritual and also other truths that you've come to believe in. And so what we're trying to bring forth in this book is the concept of right relationship that would have us living on this finite planet in a way that's true to some what we think are universal ethical and cultural and moral traditions, as well as the increasingly evident ecological reality we're living in, one in which we're now using up the earth faster than it can regenerate itself.
Well, let's talk about those universal principles. What are they?
I guess I'd offer two to give an idea of what we're looking at. One would be the Golden Rule, which in various forms is recognized in many religious and cultural traditions around the world. And the other is just the basic lesson that I think most of your listeners could relate to, of being taught at a very early age that we have to share things that are limited. And this idea of fair sharing and the Golden Rule is pretty much written right out of our mainstream economic model, and the impacts of that are becoming increasingly evident in particularly in what's happening to the ecological base of the economy. We see that in climate change. We see it in a rate of species extinction that is now, by most scientific estimates, at least 1,000 times greater than it would be without human intervention. Dead zones in the ocean, a loss of topsoil, the water crisis that is probably approaching a level equal to the climate crisis we're dealing with. I mean, we're dealing with no longer a frontier world where we're finding new places to develop, but with a full world and one where the limits, the ecological limits of that affect our way of life are becoming increasingly evident.
Well, the Golden Rule that's in effect today is those who have the gold make the rules. That being the case, you know, how do you change that?
Yeah, that's, there are no easy answers. And this book comes out of a group of Quakers asking that question and drawing on some other experiences in Quaker history where difficult moral questions, where situations that looked impossible to change were ultimately changed. And an example I'll give you there is the Quaker experience in bringing an end to the slave trade in Great Britain and the United States. And what was interesting about that is that Quakers, and this was a surprise to me as a lifelong Quaker, that Quakers in the 17th and 18th century were slave owners in both the United States and Britain. And so the conversation started among Quakers. Some groups of Quakers saying this just can't be right, that the way that we live our lives, the way that we run our economy on the backs of our fellow human beings is simply not true to our Quaker principles. It's not in right relationship with what we know to be right. And that conversation then was taken to the broader society in Great Britain and the United States, and eventually end ended the led to the end of the slave trade into slavery. So we think there's a similar potential with the situation we have now. We're dealing with an economy, a fossil fuel-based economy, a way of living that, especially in the last 50 to 100 years, has developed in a set of relationships that no longer make sense. And as that realization becomes more widespread and prevalent, then we're equipped with our basic moral bearings, these basic concepts that we, in right relationship, that we think resonate in many different groups and cultures and ethical traditions, to look for a different way. So it really does start with that kind of grounding and clarification. The other thing then, there are also some very technical sides of this. Increased thinking on what kinds of institutions, what kind of governance systems and things we need to develop and have in place when the time comes where enough people in enough places are ready to put them in place.
We're talking about the book, Right Relationship, Building a Whole Earth Economy. And we have one of the authors, Jeffrey Garver, with us by phone. You can join us and participate in this discussion as well by calling 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email. The address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. One of the traits of the culture of this country, I can't speak for other parts of the world with any authority, but one of the traits of the culture of this country, the United States, is this idea of rugged individualism, of, we're all on our own, we shouldn't expect any help from anyone else, we should be able to solve our own problems, we can go ahead and grab anything that we are capable of getting, that it's all out there and it's anybody's for the taking. And if we have the strength and the will and the courage and the ability to go out there and get it, we can have it. Some would say the spirit that built this country, and at least in the mythology of the country persists to this day. Contrast that with this view of this vision that you have in your book of what I think you refer to as a commonwealth.
Well, first of all, I think that idea of rugged individualism, there's a lot going on there that is that's extremely valuable. I mean, that the part of the American spirit that has a can-do attitude, that's where people are trying to find a make a contribution to solve problems, and focusing on personal growth that will enable them to do that is certainly a wonderful part of the tradition in the United States. And by the way, although I live in Montreal, I am a U.S. citizen and grew up in the States. And on the other hand, we live in community. We are not out there on our own. And I mentioned earlier that the contrast between a frontier mentality and a lot of, I think, rugged individualism comes from the era when we were exploring new frontiers, developing, moving west in the United States and developing new places. And that's simply not going on anymore. I mean, we've pretty much gone everywhere we can go. And so this idea of living in community is becoming more and more important. And I think it's important also to remember that that's also a big part of our tradition. When you think of barn raisings, when you think of the tradition of town meetings in New England and similar things in other parts of the world, we work together on things, and that's another very important part of the American tradition. And I'll give you an example. A person in a car can drive 200 miles per hour in the desert, no problem. You go in a straight line and you rev up your mean machine as fast as it can go, once you're in the city, you've got to obey stop signs, you've got to obey speed limits. So I think we're more and more in that kind of a situation. And the idea of a commonwealth really captures the idea that in this country and in the rest of the world, the wealth with which we run our economy, with which we make our livings and get through day to day, is limited. It's shared in common by not only just all human beings, but all members of the community of life, all other living beings as well. And so we need that independent or individual spirit and focus on personal growth, but in the context of community. So, you know, another way we talk about it in this book is we need an economy that encloses the spark of competition within a spirit of cooperation.
We're talking about the book, Right Relationship, Building a Whole Earth Economy, with one of its two authors, Jeffrey Garver. And, well, here's what former President Jimmy Carter has to say about this book. We are all stewards of the earth, but often lack specific information and advice on what we can do personally and collectively. Right Relationship provides a wonderful guide for all of us. We're discussing that book with Jeffrey Garver and with you. We have full phone lines already, my goodness. And we'll start taking calls when we come back from this short break. More of our program coming up. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll be right back. It's just about 19 minutes after 10 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's what's coming up a little bit later on the Ideas Network. The recent arrest of Harvard professor Henry Louis Gates reignited the national conversation about racism. Another event passed with hardly a whisper. After three on Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders, Jean Faraca and her guests discuss a recent resolution unanimously passed in the Senate apologizing for slavery. A look at the purpose of the apology and whether it can really contribute to racial healing. That's on Here on Earth after 3 o'clock this afternoon. This hour, we're talking about the book Right Relationship, Building a Whole Earth Economy, with one of its two authors, Jeffrey Garver. And we have a lot of callers who want to join the program, so let's take some calls. We'll start with Jack in Delavan. Jack, good morning.
Good morning. I want to thank you for the program and thank you for the book. It sounds like a wonderful voice of reason and direction in this sea of problems. I'd like your guest to comment on this, and I think he was just beginning to touch on it when your person took me on the phone here. I don't believe that most people know how to deal with the problems in the world because they feel so alone and whatever they might do would be futile. And as a Catholic Christian, I maintain that the only way we can deal with some of this is in a sense of community. I think in many places our churches are communities of Christians, but they are not Christian community. I think, to give an example, there was a gentleman who worked at Los Alamos. He decided he was a PhD scientist, but he could no longer work on atomic weapons. And in the Christian community that he was a part of, they said, we agree with your choice, and we will support you when you quit your job until you find another job. We'll pay your mortgage, pay your bills, and help you to make that moral choice. And I think those are the kinds of Christian communities or communities that we need in order to help people both make individual choices but also make group choices that will affect in a positive way the problems of the world. I'd like his comment, please.
Well, I agree that this that the sense of community and of working together is essential. I've had that experience from time to time within a faith setting, within Quakerism, where what comes out of communal action has so much more strength and solidity than anything any of us can do on our own. And there's also just the moral support that comes with working in community. And it doesn't have to be a faith community. It can be all kinds. I'll refer back to the Quaker experience in ending the slave trade, where those conversations among Quakers were gentle conversations, it really took quite some time, actually, for Quakers to stop owning slaves in the United States, around 100 years. But it's that persistent drawing on a perspective that's in common that eventually led to a completely different way of organizing their lives and taking on what really was a fear about, again, about managing without slaves, or in our case, it would be managing without a car. I think the quiet heroes we have on and in the communities of today are those people who are showing us that we can live simpler, less stressful, in many respects, happier lives when we unload some of our material possessions and develop our spiritual life or our ethical groundings and our connection to community. So I agree very much with the caller.
Jack, thanks for the call. Let's go next to Fern up on the Iron Range in Gilbert, Minnesota. Fern, good morning.
Yes. My concern comes because we are threatened with sulfide mining by Canadian company Polymet. And I've done some thinking about why we trash the earth, and I think it comes down to that we love ourselves more than the earth. We think if something is technologically feasible, it's okay. We don't teach ethics or sound science. And I'm wondering if the speaker is familiar with Dr. Blows from the University of Waterloo, who has studied sulfide mines in Canada, that practically all of them have problems, especially with regard to wetlands and mercury.
I'm not familiar with that particular work, but certainly those are some of the touchstones or the places where this dilemma and crisis we're in really hit the ground. Literally, we talk in the book about the Canadian tar sands or oil sands, as some call them, as an example of wrong relationship, of something, first of all, that's connected to what can really be analogized to an addiction. We're still struggling to try and figure out how we're going to move away from a carbon-based economy. In the meantime, we have places like the tar sands, where the boreal forest is raised off the surface of the earth. A relatively clean fossil fuel, natural gas, is used to boil water, which is then passed, steam is then passed through sand to get out this fairly dirty fossil fuel bitumen. The communities that have developed there are boom towns that have a lot of social dysfunction, lots of alcoholism, wide ranges of prosperity. In terms of there's the very rich and the very poor. Some of those poor people are members of First Nations, indigenous people that lived on that land. Others from those communities have sided with the companies, are trying to make a buck out of it. So there's been that kind of social fractionating. And then the end product gets piped down to end markets where it contributes to climate change and other ecological problems, or even you could extend that to, if it's used in cars, to a car-dominated society. So the caller also mentioned that sound science and ethical principles, those are exactly the kinds of things that our economic models of, the economic models that are under lying the news items that started this show today. We heard that personal incomes were down, and personal incomes are a big driver on whether we can get back to economic growth. And we talk about good news being economic growth is going up, bad news being economic growth goes down. And in this book we're not anti-economic growth, but we really call into question having economic growth that depends on things like the oil sands or these mines that the caller talked about being the main objective of our economy without us looking at whether the Earth can handle it, whether we can decouple economic growth from its ecological impacts. And we don't seem to have any, first of all, any clear recognition collectively that this is a problem. Our politicians certainly don't talk about it, let alone a clear and effective strategy for dealing with that, either saying, yes, we're going to have economic growth, and here is how we're going to manage the ecological impact so we can handle it, or to say, look, we just can't do that. We have to look for new economic models, look to ecological economists and others who are saying we can get by with no growth or steady state economies.
Well, what about Fern's point, we love ourselves more than the Earth?
You know, we had a lot of discussion in writing this book about the anthropocentric points of view, so points of view that are based on, that are putting people or individual people at the center, or biocentric views that look at people as members of what we call the commonwealth of life, so this broader of community of life on the Earth. And I think this, my response is connected to my response in regard to rugged individualism. I agree with the caller that we seem to have, over the last 50 to 100 years, developed more and more of an emphasis on taking care of ourselves and less on community. And the problem is the community, especially when you're talking about the entire community of life, is showing signs of real stress. So it's time for us to more broadly, or on a much broader basis, look at that community and focus on ourselves as members of a commonwealth of life, as citizens of life, and not just consumers, for example.
Well, let's take a call next from Justin in Fond du Lac. Justin, good morning.
Yes, I'm sorry, my cell phone's a little chirpy here, but I just had a question for your guest today about, I greatly admire the Quakers, especially, they're the most approachable, I think, Western Christian theology, by my opinion, but I was wondering if their work and this work specifically, if they're doing any work to get this more to like countries like China with their over-industrialization, like Japan with their over-hunting of the cetacean population worldwide, and how that's been coming along, or if they're doing anything like that, and if the book is being sent to places like China and Japan. And that's all.
Well, we certainly would love to have the book translated into Chinese and Japanese, and we've actually had some feelers on that, so we're very encouraged by that. The authors of this book do come from North America, and one of our contributing authors, Robert Howell, is from New Zealand. Let me just mention our three contributing authors, Robert Howell, Steve Segge, and Keith Helmuth. But of course, that is, in some senses, a limited perspective. We tried certainly to be aware of the rest of the world and to describe what we're talking about, this idea of right relationship, in terms that resonates broadly in other traditions. I think Buddhism, for example, has similar notions of right relationship. There certainly seems to be a kind of symbiosis, certainly with China in the United States right now. Their industrial activity, up until very recently, has been very much tied to consumption in the developed world, and very much so in the United States. You know, we get indebted to them by selling treasury bills, and they then keep their currency low so they can produce all this stuff that we're buying. And both the Chinese and the Americans are kind of together on this idea that we just have to keep that growth engine going, and just hope at some point we'll be able to deal with these ecological crises without having a very good plan. We hear a lot about a new partnership with the Chinese lately. Well, a partnership on a concerted effort. I mean, the most telling partnership that will come out at some point this year is whether the U.S. and China and other key players in the climate change game are able to get their act together so that there's a plan for fair sharing of our use of the atmosphere to dump our greenhouse gases.
Well, let's talk about the global economy a little bit. Your book seems to suggest that the globalization of the economy was not a very good thing. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, it's really not the idea of globalization per se, but just the way that it's promoted and the way it's allowed to proceed. And right now, our global economy is really driven by disparities between the developing world and the developed world. So most of the consumption and so on goes on in the developed world. And again, China is a good example. It wants to increase economic growth, at least for the time being, by having relatively weaker environmental and labor rules, and that allows them to make huge advances and then satisfy our addiction in this part of the world on consumption. And there's been nothing at the global level that would compare, for example, to what happened in the United States in the 60s and 70s, where the environmental impacts, at least the ones that were evident at that time, just reached a point where we knew we had to develop a different system. We had the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland was bursting into flames on a regular basis. Air pollution problems in many parts of the country and other problems led to vast majorities or bipartisan consensus in our Congress that we needed to have federal rules so that everybody was playing by the same rules, and there would be an even playing field for economic activity. People wouldn't use their weaker labor environmental laws in their states to have an advantage. We haven't developed anything close to that on the global stage. Europe has had more success than certainly North America or the Americas have, and so that's kind of the game that's going on at the global level, and it's allowing this accelerated throughput of energy and resources that, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, is now using up the Earth's ecological capacity faster than it can be regenerated. There's a lot more to say about that. You know, this is also a result of what happened in the Bretton Woods talks that led to the creation of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. And you know, basically, the decision there was to use the United States dollar as the world reserve currency and to reject the British proposal developed by John Maynard Keynes to have an international trade currency that would be adjusted against national currencies. And this gets kind of complicated, but the overall effect would have been that countries would have been driven more to self-sufficiency. So kind of taking care of themselves and using a globalized trade as a secondary means of generating economic activity, rather than everybody trying to outrace each other to be the biggest exporter, which is kind of the situation we have now. Trade surpluses and deficits always balance out, and we have a system that's designed to get countries wanting to be, everybody wanting to have a trade surplus. It's just not going to work out, and it leads to dysfunction and ecological and social crises.
Let's take another call. This time we'll go to Tom in River Falls.
Hey, John.
Tom, good morning.
Me?
Yes, I can.
Yeah, I wanted to go back to this, what you introduced, John, called this myth in America of rugged individualism, and Jeffrey tried to give an answer, and I'd like to boil it down to, basically, I think what he was trying to say was this dynamic tension between democracy and our economic system known as capitalism. And, of course, we always have to try to seek a balance, but, of course, democracy equals cooperation, we the people, we as a society, versus capitalism, which is competition, greed, or, you know, the me society, rugged individualism. And I think, of course, since the Reagan Revolution in the last 30 years, we've drifted towards this me society. And he's trying, I think Jeffrey's trying to say, we have to get back to this we society, which is our founding. I mean, the first three words of the Constitution, we the people, not me the person. And there always is this tension between capitalism in our government, or our form of governance known as democracy. So I'd like, in fact, I wanted to find out whether Jeffrey knows this book called What Would Jefferson Do? A Return to Democracy by Tom Hartman. And he goes into this whole dynamic tension between the two systems.
I haven't read that book. There's many wonderful books out to get to. I agree very much with the caller. And I don't know if there's much more to say about it. There's a lot. There's another good book that talks about this dilemma we're in. I think in a similar way is Gus Speth's recent book, The Bridge at the Edge of the World, where he's envisioning a post-capitalist society, not necessarily socialist, and although. You know, that seems to be bandied about pretty carelessly these days, those kind of accusations. But you know, just a recognition that you know, we're living in a new situation right now. When I talk about the Earth being used up faster than it can regenerate itself, this is really reflected in ecological footprint research, which says that starting in maybe the late 1980s or so, for the very first time, the total human global footprint, ecological footprint, was greater than the ecological capacity of the Earth. And since that time, we've been using up that ecological capacity faster than it can regenerate. In other words, our footprint, our ecological footprint, has been bigger than one Earth. And we know everything that's contributing to that, those aren't just straight-line curves that are going up. They're kind of ski-jump curves. They're going up exponentially. That's the picture of this new situation, a situation that has never existed before in human history. And, you know, the me-I approach works perhaps fine when you're dealing with wide open spaces and an undeveloped Earth. It's a disaster when you have the situation we have now, and that's why we're dealing with a crisis that needs urgent attention. And you know, it's a real test of our democracy as well, because one of the ways we have to get together is to put in place leaders who are going to recognize this situation and come up with clear and effective strategies for dealing with it.
Well, some would say real democracy is simply the tyranny of the majority. And there is a lot of competition inherent in a democracy because the object is to obtain power so that you can you know, carry out whatever your political program is. At least that's the way democracy has evolved in most of the countries of the world where it's at least given lip service as the governmental model. It seems to me that goes along very well with capitalism in terms of the idea of the idea is to get as much stuff or power or money, which I guess is really the same thing, as you can, and to prevent others from taking it away from you.
Well, it's hard to argue that. Perhaps the hope lies in those examples in history where, despite those dynamics, we've managed to put in place dramatically different systems. You know, the sort of the radical steps taken in the New Deal, the response to the environmental crisis in the 60s and 70s. You know, the problem since then seems to be that, first of all, there has been, I think, a demonization of government, a government as something other than us, rather than us, which it really should be, and a tremendous improvement in the ability of the mechanics that you've just described, John, is to be able to prevent reform. You know, we're seeing that now with healthcare slogans about socialism and distortions of information backed by huge money interests. Same thing with climate change. What seems to be a pretty clear scientific consensus. You never have entire certainty on these questions. You know, being influenced by this sort of outsized, over-magnified questioning of that consensus by moneyed interests. So I don't know what to say other than that's part of the dilemma that we're facing. The hope is that at some point the choice between chaos and doing something completely different will become stark, and we'll have another breakthrough. That's certainly what's needed.
Well, I guess the key question is, how do you get to that? Because right now, at least, again, speaking only for the United States, my observation will be what we're getting now is bread and circuses. And as long as the population can be distracted enough and there's enough food to go around and there aren't any real crises, at least not that we can see because of whatever media choices we make, where does the groundswell, where does the impetus, absent a major catastrophe, where does the impetus for the kinds of changes you believe are necessary come from?
Well, where I have some hope, and let me make a distinction between, at least in my mind, hope and optimism, because I just don't know whether I can feel optimistic about this. But where I see hope is in the many places around the United States and Canada, the places I'm familiar with, where groups of people are saying, look, we're going to go off and we're going to do something on our own. The places that have developed local currencies, the dramatic increase in things like community-supported agriculture, just the Transition Town movement, and if your listeners don't know about that, I encourage them to check it out. It's a pretty fascinating movement that started in England with towns or broader regions deciding they're going to take an approach according to a set of principles that is set out, and this is an organized effort, the Transition Town effort, to make a transition to a low carbon economy. The cities that and municipalities that are making the best progress in terms of green building and green infrastructure and green planning, those I think are where the change is going to come, and hopefully the success of those kinds of approaches will become more and more apparent and they can take hold. On the individual side, this breaking off of addictions is a difficult thing to do, and the kind of epiphanies or catharses people have when they realize, oh my gosh, I'm actually much better off with this thing, without this thing I thought I was dependent on. That's a very hard thing to predict how and when it's going to come about. I happen to think it's essential. It's part of the appeal we make in this book as the starting point for individuals. And the hope is that these experiments and a new approach can capture our collective imagination in time so that we can adapt before crisis gets completely out of control.
Well, I just want to, I'll read a line from the preface to your book. You say, economics based on consumerism and obsession with growth has become, in effect, the modern world's state-sponsored religion. It sounds to me like what you're asking for is a modern reformation.
Well, mass epiphany is another word that we use in the book. It's really, we talk in the book about axial ages, and I think that the consensus among authors is that we are at a point in history, again, framed by this ecological reality, this situation that we've never before faced on this planet, that it's taken us to a point where we need to have that kind of reformation and completely different approach.
The late Reverend Leonard Ravenhill would say we need a revival. We need to take a break right now and revive ourselves, I guess, and then when we come back, we'll continue our discussion. We've got people on the phone who want to join in, and we'll take some more calls when we come back. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's just about 10:49. Here's what's coming up when Larry Mueller steps in after 11. Well, Larry will learn, and we will too, why birds call and sing. His guests are experienced birders John Feith of Madison and Steve Bechtol of Eau Claire. Why do birds call and sing? With Larry Mueller after 11 this morning. This hour, we're talking about the book Right Relationship, Building a Whole Earth Economy, with one of its authors, Jeffrey Garver, the book published by Barrett Kohler Publishers. We have callers. Let's go to Ernest in Hayward first. Ernest, good morning.
I think one hope is a market that reflects true prices. Later today, I'm going to go to the U.S. EPA labs in Duluth, Minnesota, where we're going to talk about how to spend $475 million in stimulant money to restore the Great Lakes. The irony of it is that much of the degradation of the Great Lakes has come about through subsidized activities. So we're piling subsidy upon subsidy, and it's not just the big companies. People don't want to pay higher water and sewer rates. We've been subsidized there since the Clean Water Act of 1972, at least. So how can we have a right relationship with nature when the government is subsidizing our depletion and pollution of natural resources?
Well, that's a big problem. I agree. We're very, very far from getting the price right on things. And even economists, or even free market economists, typically recognize that there are imperfections in the market, and environmental externalities are a classic example. Unless you force a company to put in measures that are going to control pollution, which then affects the price, they don't have a natural tendency to do that. It's going to perhaps cut into profits. Of course, you can't expect anyone to do that if their competitors aren't doing that either. That's sort of the basic philosophy behind environmental regulation. You know, the problem is that we haven't gone far enough. Another irony that's related to this is that all of this money, the stimulus money, or will then contribute to gross domestic product. So, it's like having to put in air conditioning because climate change is causing your city to be warmer than it was before. You have to now compensate for that by spending money on the air conditioner, contributing to GDP. It's kind of a vicious cycle. Another example there is that the oil in the Exxon Valdez, by being spilled and getting the lawyers involved, getting the emergency management teams involved, and all the activity involved in dealing with that spill, contributed more to GDP than that oil would have contributed had it reached its endpoint in the market. And we need better measures, and certainly there's a lot of government subsidies in agriculture and energy development and other places that seems to be completely contrary to what's needed.
Well, part of the impetus for that is it not the rise of the professional political class? I mean, you've got people whose only job has been to be elected to office for years and probably wouldn't know what to do if they weren't. If they weren't an elected representative of some sort. I mean, how can we expect people to stand up and say, look, this is really going to hurt and you're just going to have to take it because it is what it is, when they know that saying that means that they will, at the next cycle, be out of a job?
I wish there was an easy answer to that. I was dismayed in Canada last December when the party in power proposed to get rid of public funding of elections in Canada, and thankfully in Canada, elections only last about 6 weeks. It's basically from the time to the less time than from between our conventions in the United States and our presidential elections. They basically wanted to go more to U.S. style special interest money dominated politics. This is one of the things where it seemed that there was a vast public consensus on the need for change, and it's one of those things where another hope bubble that there's not that much hope that it's going to go through that came out of the last election in the United States.
Let's talk about the Obama administration for just a moment. Where are they in terms of, how do you think they're doing in terms of the kind of economic model you're looking at?
Yeah, I'm familiar with and know some of the people involved on the environment and energy and climate side of things, and I have tremendous respect for those people. But I think on the economic side, there doesn't seem to be a clear opening for not necessarily moving away from an economic growth-based model. I mean, that's pretty much politically impossible, but at least starting to ask some questions about how you're going to manage the ecological effects of growth if growth is deemed to be necessary to our economy. I guess I'm in the camp that's been disappointed that there hasn't been a different kind of response. A much clearer twinning of this ecological crisis that I mentioned, and the much more temporary economic and financial crisis we're dealing with.
Let's take a call from Bill in Madison next. Bill, good morning.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Go ahead. Yes, I can. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you for the opportunity, but personally, as I see it, it's based in largely in American religious tradition. We have a tradition, I think it's based on Calvinist idea that that material wealth is a sign of God's favor. The evangelical movement is especially loud on this point that, if you give money to God, you will be rewarded with riches beyond your, dreams, et cetera, et cetera. And I think it's buried deep in the American character, the idea that personal wealth is a sign of your favor of God, from God, and if you're poor, it's a character flaw. You're being punished for sins of your past, whatever. It's a perversion of Christianity. It's been around for a long time, but it's unfortunately buried very, very deeply in American culture. And,
okay.
Greed and avarice are as American as apple pie and baseball. And
we're almost at
that there's going to be any motivation for the sea change that you call for, short of catastrophe.
Okay, we're almost out of time, so I need to let our guest respond. We have less than a minute. Please see if you can deal with it in that amount of time.
Yeah. I mean, luckily, our religious traditions have, and the Bible and other sources have different stories to tell, and there's plenty in there to work with that goes more to creation care, and there are some signs within interfaith movements that there is some rethinking going on. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that we do connect our notion of right relationship in this book with Aldo Leopold, who's from your neck of the woods. I want to be sure to mention that. So one way that we describe right relationship is that a thing is right if it preserves and enhances integrity, resilience, and beauty of the commonwealth of life. That's really what we put forth as both the ethical and scientific basis and beacon that we should be working towards as we work towards a different kind of economy.
Well, and that, I'm afraid, is where we're going to have to leave it because we're out of time. Jeffrey Garver, thank you for spending this hour with us.
It's been a real pleasure.
Jeffrey Garver is one of the authors of the book Right Relationship, Building a Whole Earth Economy, published by Barrett Kohler Publishers. Carmen Jackson produced this program. On-air production handled today by Beto McQuaid and Dave Potraz. I'll be back tomorrow morning at 9 with more here on the Ideas Network. Stay tuned. Larry Mueller is up after the news. If you'd like to listen to this program again, if you caught just the tail end of it, you can go to our website, WPR.org. And later today, you should be able to listen to the whole thing. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network.